We're ready?
Christine?
My bad.
Yep.
Representative Pruitt?
Here.
Representative Gruenberg?
Here.
Representative Foster? Representative Ledoux?
Present.
Representative Lynn?
Here. And present.
Representative Millett? Representative
oh, I found it. Okay.
Here. Okay, we've got a quite a list to juggle today, and so we're going to start with 282. The intent was to start with SB 64, but we are just getting now an amendment that came from Legal Services that Doug Gardner is going to be online to explain. And but we're going to start with 282. I think we're ready to go on that, and then we'll go to SB 64. And there's a possibility that we will go to HB 60 first and take the 15 minutes. If my staff, Ernest, isn't back from the Senate Judiciary, we're just kind of juggling everybody around. So anyway, HB 60 may be second. But when we get to SB 64, my intent is to move it today if we possibly can. You know, that's the goal. And so if there's unless there's a... real bombshell that nobody has seen. I think we have got everything in line. So we're going to start with HB 282. If you would, tell us where we're at, give us a refresher, and identify yourself for the record before you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Doug Isaacson of House District 1, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Brenda Hewitt. And we have in front for your consideration, as requested, the CS for House Bill number 282 Judiciary. It is version Y. And we have provided for you a comparison, and it should be in your packets. It's this big gray and white one. Excuse me. And it provides a differentiation, a sectional analysis of the changes that have been made so that it's really easy for you to see and to compare whether or not the version includes all that you had considered. Excuse me. For question's sake, brevity's sake, I'll let that sit unless you have some questions, and at which time I'll ask Brenda, to who has been working diligently on this, and can recite by heart all the changes, and she can answer those.
Okay, before you proceed, Brenda, does everybody have that side-by-side comparison in front of you that we just related to?
I do not.
Jan, we'll take it easier a little bit. Okay, we all have the information in front of us, the comparisons, and everybody's had a chance to look it over. Brenda, if you would, you can wrap up here with what you have to say.
I'm Brenda Hewitt. I'm staff to Representative Doug Isaacson. I think we incorporated all of the amendments that we had during the last meeting. If you'll notice, in order to retain the word uniform, we removed sections 1, 2, 3, and 17, which caused everything to be renumbered. So section 1 is what was formerly known as section 4. It had a real small technical change going
just
from the
word. Let me stop you for a little bit.
Sure.
My problem. Could I have a motion to put version Y in front of us just to make
Mr.
sure?
Chair, I would move version Y of CS for House Bill number 282 Judiciary.
Okay, that's 0930 version Yankee. So, okay, I'm sorry. Please proceed.
My pleasure. So it becomes section 4 now becomes section 1, and it was just mostly housekeeping in that one, going from the word parties to landlord and tenant. Section 2 was the former section 5. This is the one that reaffirms the maximum amount of prepaid rent or deposits that can be made at 2 months unless you're adding on another month for pets, and that's dealt with a little further on in the bill as well. Section 3 becomes what was Section 6. This is a definition for normal wear and tear. Section 4 was the former Section 7, and this is where the landlord has to separately account for each tenant's prepaid rent and security deposits and restricts it for that use of that particular unit. Section 5 was the former Section 8. This allows the landlord to have up to 30 days to return a damaged deposit if there's been damage. So it changes from 14 to 30, but just if there's damage. Now the Section 6 is now the former Section 9, and this one had several pieces in it. So it permits for the additional deposit for pets. It defines normal wear and tear, and it also brings forward a definition for what is truly a service animal versus a comfort animal. And I see I have a typo in here, so it says serve animal instead of service, so I apologize for that. On Section 7 is the former Section 10, and this is where both the landlord and the tenant sign a premise condition statement when they move in, and this will help in when people move out in defining what actually is damage or normal wear and tear.
Mr. Chair?
We're going to hold the questions until she gets all the way through.
Section 8 is the former Section 11, allows for the rental of dry cabins if both parties agree. Section 9, as the former Section 12, this allows the landlord to restrict the number of inhabitants, and it was amended at the last meeting to include the words or through the rental agreement. Section 10 was the former Section 13. This adds a new subsection that allows the landlord to request that the tenant return the dwelling in substantially the same condition, including if they professionally clean the carpets, they can request that the tenant professionally clean them before they leave. We removed Section 14. Section 15 becomes Section 11, and this is where the landlord has an expedited eviction process for tenants that are engaged in illegal activities. We removed Section 16 that gave a transient occupancy definition. We also removed Section 17 that had the word uniform. Section 12 is the former Section 18. This allows the landlords to collect unpaid rent on someone's permanent dividend check in number 8th ranking. And that's it, sir.
Okay. Thank you. We have first a question from Representative Ledoux and then a question from Representative Grunberg.
I'm just curious about Section 2. And actually, it's not the change in Section 2 that I'm curious about. It's how it was right at the very beginning. Why doesn't it apply to rental units where the rent exceeds $2,000 a month? I mean, what's the rationale behind that?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, actually, this is part of the current law, and I honestly don't know that, but if legal, if Ed Sniffen is online or...
Ed Sniffen, you're online for questions. Did you hear the question?
Yes, Chairman. For the record, Ed Sniffen from the Department of Law. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, loud and clear. Very nice. It looks like it's going to work today.
Yeah. I've heard some confusion with some other teleconnections, so I'm glad you can hear me. For the record, Ed Sniffen with the Attorney General's Office here in Anchorage. Yeah, I did hear the question, and it's an excellent question, Representative Ledoux, through the chair. I don't really know what the uniform commissioners thought when they put that $2,000 limit in there, to be honest with you. I can try and find out and get you that answer if it bugs you enough, but yeah, I'm stumped at that one as well.
Okay. So we don't.
I actually would appreciate an answer, but I don't want it to hold up this bill. If anybody has an answer, I just sort of like to know it, but.
Okay, great. Maybe you get the answer on that, Ed, if you get it to the committee, and I will be happy to distribute it. Interesting question. Representative Grunberg.
I'll do that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I don't know the answer to your question, but I know that this bill was the Uniform Act, and it was enacted 70s or thereabout. I'm quite sure it was in the 70s or maybe even earlier. And I could only hazard a guess that it may be in very expensive units. You would want to have more of a security deposit because they might have expensive furnishings or floor covering, something like that.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg, respectfully, you had a question too? Let's move on to that.
Yeah, I did. To Ms. Hewitt. You said that there was a typo on in the word service. Where's that?
Oh, I did that in my in the sectional analysis that I gave you, and I apologize, but that was in. In one of the dark versions here. There it is. No, here it is. It's at the very top of, would be your third page, at the very top when I'm talking about section 9.
What section are you in?
Representative Grunberg, if you would, for the secretary, please come through the chair.
If you do the chair.
Would you give us a line in the page and the section?
The typo is not in the bill. The typo is in my analysis.
Oh.
So that's what I'm apologizing
now
for.
Now we're on the same page.
I couldn't find it in the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the sponsor? Is anybody online that would like to testify on HB 282? Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on HB 282? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. And the bills for the committee for 10 amendments, is it? Or no, what is it? No, it's before the committee as far as for discussion and suggestions and debate. Representative?
I'm happy with the bill.
would you make a motion to that effect, then?
I'd love to make a motion. Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill number 282, Judiciary 28/LS0930/Y, with individual recommendations and zero fiscal. Is there a zero fiscal note, or is there no fiscal note?
Zero fiscal note.
Zero fiscal note.
Yeah, they always have a fiscal note.
And a company.
Yeah, you get off the hook by just saying accompanying fiscal
notes.
Accompanying
fiscal notes.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. What we're going to do is take a little at ease, and then we'll get oriented for the next bill. And we're going to spend about 15 minutes on HB 60, and then we'll be moving to SB 64 and spending most of the rest of the time on that. We'll see how that goes. So, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We should have the latest version of House Bill 60 in front of us, and right now that's the Y version, and I hope adopted that for discussion. Have we adopted that for discussion?
The Y version?
Yeah.
I don't see the Y.
Yeah, it's been moved, and I think I have an outstanding objection on version Y. It is for discussion, so it's in front of us. Hey, version Y, okay. 0265 Yankee is before us.
Okay. I have on the line a variety of all my witnesses who are available to answer questions, and if we could maybe put on the record the folks who are online so that everybody knows who's available.
We have online, we have Doug Blotmacher from the Alaska Trust Company. We have that wants to testify. We have Brandon Centula. Again, they testified very briefly last time, but those two want to testify for questions. We got Ben Brzeski and from Uniform Law Commission, Matthew Blotmacher from the Trust Company, and Beth Chapman. They're there to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've already vetted this. As the members will know, the bill is smaller than it originally was in one sense and expanded in another sense. Section 1 is the choice of law provision that the trust folks have asked for, which will allow trusts that are administered in this state to have as a default provision, if there's nothing in the trust agreement, choice of law provision where the law of Alaska will apply. And that's quite important for the administration of trusts. And the remainder of the bill is simply the Uniform Property Transfer on Death Act. It's a uniform act that takes the place of going through the expensive probate will process or having a trust. And there are a few things that conform the probate code to that. We have eliminated the provision in the previous version, which originally allowed joint tenancy with the right of survivorship. And that has been eliminated. That was the repealer section, which in the Labor and Commerce version was towards the end of the bill. And that provision was section 5 on page 12, line 28, repealing AS 3415130. The current state of the law is that you cannot have, in the state of Alaska, joint tenancy with the right of survivorship, where the property passes to the surviving owners and gives a present ownership, unless it's tenancy by the entirety, which is to a husband and wife, and that must meet the definition of husband and wife under Alaska law. So there should be no expansion in this bill of the right of same-sex couples. And if that is the chair's concern, we can put that on the record. That should be extremely clear. And that concludes my comment. I'm here to help answer questions, and my people are. And please, it's an important bill. And I want to assure the chair, if that's his concern, that that's what the bill does.
Yeah, if so there is no expansion whatsoever on the different rights that are tied to tenancy groups, you know, tenancy definitions like right of survivorship, and all that is all remains unchanged just by existing law.
As I understand it, yes, Mr. Rozinke, who's for the commission, will confirm that, and the Blotmachers can on their portion too. But that is what the bill does not do.
Okay, that will satisfy me, and I, looking through it, I see now that I was confused with the earlier versions and some of your documentation on the bill that were used to include that. So the option is still open here for action. Okay. So next we go to any other questions for the sponsor?
The witnesses are just for questions. I don't think, unless somebody wants to say anything. We had a conference call yesterday. Nobody felt the burning need to say anything additional, but they're here to answer your questions or anybody else's, sir.
Okay, thank you. Ben Orzeski from the Uniform Law and Commission, were you listening to that conversation there between Representative Gruenberg and myself?
Yes, this is Ben Orzeski, and I did hear that conversation.
Would you restate the confirmation that Representative Gruenberg gave us so we can just process it?
Yes, I'll confirm that there's nothing in this bill or the Uniform Act that expands the right of any couple, heterosexual or homosexual, to transfer property in any way. It simply is it doesn't have to do with whether you're married or not. There's nothing in the act that would change that.
So it doesn't expand or change the rights. You said expand, but it doesn't. There's no change of any anything. It's all based on existing state law, consistent with our clause in the Constitution. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. I have no more questions. Is there anybody in the room who wants to testify on HB 60?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to also note that Terry Thurbin, the commissioner, is available for questions as well.
Terry, hi. I didn't say hi. I saw you out there. Doug Blotmacher, you did put down that you wanted to testify, and Representative Gruenberg has stated that you didn't have a burning need to. Is that correct?
Yes, Chairman, that is correct.
And the same for Brandon? Hearing nothing?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you, Brandon. With that, we're going to close public testimony then. I think we got it all. And it's before the committee for discussion or action.
Okay, no discussion, Mr. Chair. I would move... I'd move a CS for House Bill number 60-28-LS0265-P.
Oh, it's Y.
I got it right here, Y, and with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor.
Take a brief at ease, and what we're doing now is getting ready for SB 64.
And thank the witnesses, too.
On the record?
Mr. Chair, I would move House CS for Senate Bill number 64, Judiciary. That would be 28-LS0116 /M for consideration.
Okay, great. Seeing no objection, I'm going to go right to my staff and to Senator Coghill's staff to explain, give us just a starter here where we're at. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ernest Prox, staff to Rep. Keller. The M version that you have before you is the culmination of all the amendments that we passed last week. And then the colored version, if you should all have it, that shows where each of the changes were made. And so that's the M version before you. There is an amendment, M6, that addresses some of the concerns that Doug Gardner from Ledge Legal brought up regarding the custodial interference. And then there was, I think, one he had discussed about the dates relating to the term of the commission. M6 is before you, or will have to be offered, but that's the only amendment that we have for potential consideration.
So what we'll do to proceed is we will go ahead and move M6, and then we've got Doug online to help us understand exactly what his concerns are. After we deal with Amendment M6, I'm going to ask Annie from the Department of Law to come up, and she wants to put some things on the record. And then after that, I'll probably give Jordan a chance to do a wrap-up as he sees, and we'll see where we're at that point. So, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question for Ernest. Is M6 an omnibus amendment, or are they all related? All the things in here, or should I ask Doug that?
Through the chair, it's sort of both.
Okay, I'll ask Doug when he goes on. Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, can I have a motion to move M6?
I'll for discussion only, move that we adopt M6.
Okay, we're going to call M6 number one today, amendment number one, and. What we're going to do, I object to the amendment for purposes of explanation, and what we're going to do is go directly to Doug if you're online.
I am, Representative Keller. Thank you.
Okay. Would you explain what you have proposed here in amendment number one?
All right. For the committee, Doug Gardner, Legislative Legal Services. I believe there was a memo that I authored on April 6th that was distributed. There was a concern about, to distill it down to its lowest common denominator, I guess, there was a concern about a lot of mental states all converging in this offense. And there was a conceptual amendment the last time, I believe, the committee wrote. We tried to fold the conceptual amendment into the offense in a way that worked, and I'm not sure that it's a thing of beauty. And during the course of the last several days, I spoke with Assistant Attorney General Annie Carpinetti and the Public Defender Quinlan Steiner at the request of staff to try and see if there was a way to work through the offense and get language that worked. And in the end, and I hope I'm representing this correctly, I know that Ms. Carpinetti is there. I don't know if Quinlan Steiner's online, but I believe that there was a consensus that the offense, the way that it was created in the M. Mary version, with the two amendments proposed at the top of Amendment 1 here that you have before you today, deleting legal, is probably the best language that we could come up with. My understanding was the Department of Law felt that the offense worked, and I believe the public defender also felt that the offense worked that way. I think we still believe it's quite a mouthful, but with that, I think that's the best resolution that could be achieved. So Mr. Chairman, that's the first piece of this, and I don't know if there's a question there.
Doug, thank you. We'll stop right there to see. I want you to continue, but I want to say that Quinlan Steiner is online, and Quinlan, feel free to you are there for questions, but if you have something to correct, now's the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's Mr. Gardner's statement was a fair one, that removing the word legal was not going to cause any problems.
Okay. And the Assistant Attorney General, Annie, has not signaled me. So, Representative Grunberg, you have a question for Doug?
I just want to be sure I understand what's going on here. Looking at the memo, it looks like he's trying to simplify this offense. And it was that the mental state that must be proven be each of these as an element beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant had to know at the time of the representation that they were made to a lawful custodian, and that the defendant had no legal right to take and keep the victim. And number two, the offender had to have the specific intent to take and keep the child or incompetent victim at the time they made the representations. And number three, the defendant had to knowingly misrepresent, that probably should be, to a lawful custodian that they have the right to take and keep the child. And if I may ask a few questions, please, Mr. Chair.
One at a time, go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
First, Doug, do you happen to have your memo in front of you?
I do.
I'm looking at the second paragraph, second line from the bottom. And three, the offender has to knowingly represent. You really do mean, although you use the word represent, you really do mean it's a misrepresentation, right?
Doug?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think that you're knowingly representing that you have the right to keep the child or incompetent person. I mean, when you read that in the context of the overall offense, you know, if you're the person committing the offense, you know that you have no legal right to do so, but you're representing that you do. And so I think that the result is as you've described. I don't think if Representative Grunberg, you were thinking that we should change the word from represent to misrepresent, I would say that wouldn't be necessary.
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wasn't intending to change it, but I just wanted that on the record so that if a court looks at the record for this bill, they'll hopefully be able to see Mr. Gardner's memo here and also this dialogue, and I'm glad we did that.
Okay, second question, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Now, we're removing the word legal from two places, line 6 and line 8. What is the impact of removing that word from a legal point of view, Mr. Gardner, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the discussion yesterday, and I know the public defender's on the line, I'd ask him to jump in, you know, if I don't get this right, but the discussion, what I took away from the discussion yesterday, and from, you know, when you look at this issue of legal right in the context of the statute the way it was before these amendments were done, the idea was that in custodial interference, you may have a person, you may have a mother and a father, one of whom has custody of the child, the other doesn't. And the idea behind that offense was to prevent the bad thing from happening, which is for the parent that does not have a piece of paper saying they have custody from interfering with the legal custody of the person who has been awarded by the court custody or has paper that says they have a legal right to this child. In the context of the added offense where we have a non-custodial person And the bad thing that the law is trying to prevent is for this person who isn't related to the child, that doesn't have custody, from coming in and representing that they have a right to take the child. I believe that the two parties on the call, the public defender and the State Department of Law, concluded, and this is what I got from the conversation, that the idea of having a legal right makes a lot more sense in the context of custodial interference than it does when you're talking about the next door neighbor or somebody else who might come in to pick a child up at school, for example. And so my understanding is the Department of Law didn't want to, in that context, try and unravel what legal right was. They were happier to just leave legal out and try a case before the jury and let the jury evaluate whether the person had a right to take that child. And I hope I've encapsulated the conversation correctly.
Mr. Jim Grunberg has a follow-up.
Yeah, that makes it clear. That's so that they don't get into a mini discussion in the criminal trial of the court's custody decree when it's really unnecessary for the gravamen of the offense. It's to simplify this a bit, but not to disallow that to be raised if it happens to be a real issue. It's just to simplify it a bit. Is that right, through the chair?
Through the chair, Doug Gardner again, Representative Grunberg. I think that's a fair characterization, and I think that the conversation that we had yesterday, trying to work through this, it touched on that idea that, you know, how are we going to ever, in the course of a trial with this offense, have, I don't think the term mini trial was used, but I think it's an apt description of what might happen if we're trying to figure out what legal right is in the context of, you know, this part of the offense as opposed to the custodial part at the in the other subsection. So, yes, I think that you've hit it.
Mr. Chair, speaking as a family lawyer, I think this is a lousy idea. It could be full employment for us as expert witnesses on both sides of every case that comes down, and I apologize to my brethren in the family law, but I'm going to support the deletion of the word legal.
Okay. What we're going to do is take a little bit of a did you have another question?
Not on that, but we have to go through the rest of the...
Right, I know. I'm going to take a little of ease here. On the record, and we'll go back to Doug, and if you would continue on, I think you're down to line six on amendment number one.
Representative Keller, with respect to the next amendment, I'm sorry, I just need to orient here for a second. Pardon me, but
just for clarification while you're looking, Doug, we're calling this all amendment number one, so you're continuing on the same amendment, but the second alteration in the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Keller. Moving to page 19, line one of amendment number one, the correction, taking out the court and the person is required. I think it was a mistake that was caught. It was a product of a conversation between myself and Tiffany Thomas at DMV, who I was asked to speak with, and she, I think, flagged this issue. A lot's gone on in the last day, but I think that's where the mistake was. She saw this. I think the concern was that we have this section G applying to both the court and the department, and now here in 4, unfortunately, we just had it referring to the court, and so we substitute that with the person is required so that we didn't, you know, we avoid that problem of just referring to the court in that section.
Okay, seeing no questions, go ahead.
So on page 19, line 23, same page down a little further, the concern here was with respect to the reference here is the 24/7 program. And 1 through 7 is essentially the checklist that has to occur in order for the court or the department to be able to give people in the therapeutic court program, after some pretty stringent requirements are met, a limited license. And in this context, the 24/7 piece, I believe Tiffany Thomas, I think, had a concern that how would DMV be, DMV's not really set up to verify a person's day-to-day performance in the 24/7 program. And I'm hoping that she's online and can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the idea here was that 24/7 could, you know, for that portion of the time, that first portion of the time when someone's on a limited license, the court or the department could require that the person comply with, I'm sorry, participate in, rather than comply with. I think the idea was that DMV really probably couldn't always on a day-to-day basis monitor a person's actual compliance with 24/7. DMV's more set up to determine whether someone's actually participating in a program, much like they do today with an interlock for a misdemeanor limited license. And so that's what's going on there. Ernest Prex or Jordan Schilling from Senator Coghill's office might be able to add more about the policy situation, but this change was designed to make it work for DMV, and of course it's for the committee to make a final decision on, but that's what I know about that.
Okay, Tiffany is online. Tiffany, did you have any clarifications, or did Doug explain it well?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tiffany Thomas with Division of Motor Vehicles. Mr. Gardner touched on the majority of what our concerns were. We didn't have any mechanism to authenticate. If a person was before us trying to get a limited license, we wouldn't know whether they had participated or not in 24/7, so that was a concern that we brought to his attention, and he appears to have fixed it.
Okay. I don't see any questions this time, so I'm going to have Doug go ahead. But I appreciate you putting that on the record, because it does raise, of course, a policy question of who is responsible. And that is on the record, and it will be dealt with by Jordan and my staff, Ernest, as this bill moves on, if it needs to be. I'm sure that question will come back up. So, Doug, if you would continue on with from line 15, I believe you're in, on amendment number one.
Thank you, Chairman Keller. Page 19, line 28. Page 19, line 28 was an amendment that I believe Nancy Mead from the court system forwarded through staff for either yourself or Senator Coghill regarding a concern that the court had a concern that if the way the bill's written, that if a person were in therapeutic court, that the court might have difficulty taking away the person's limited license if they were otherwise doing things in the program that the treatment team felt were risky or were not participating in the program. As the committee members know, the therapeutic court treatment team has been, along with the judge as the final decision maker, been given a lot of discretion about how people are treated in that program, and this would maintain the judge's and the treatment team's ability to take a license back if the person were not compliant with the conditions of the treatment program. Of course, the person is represented in that process typically, and so if there were disputes about that, the court would resolve them. But this would allow the court, if it felt that the public was at risk or the person was at risk, to take a license back in that circumstance. So that's what the amendment does.
Okay, thank you. Proceed. That makes sense.
Okay, I think that this is a significant policy piece that the committee. I would highlight this for the committee. Page 21, line 25. So keep in mind that a misdemeanant or a felon can go into therapeutic court. And it's typically an 18-month program. And as a person works through that, this bill allows that person under very structured circumstances to be able to get a limited license. Now, the way that Section 33, 2835-030-OOSCR was drafted up until this point, it provided a situation where only a felon in the program, not a refusal felon, but a person that provided a breath sample and who has otherwise graduated from the program, O allows requires the department to restore that license. Now, the way the bill is currently drafted, it would only allow that situation with respect to a felon. This is a complicated area, and I hope that we've done this right, and I don't know if Tiffany Thomas may have a comment about this, but by inserting B, you're putting the people who are felons in the program on the same footing as the people who are misdemeanants in the program. So you could have someone in the program that has four DUIs and is a felon, felony DUI, or you could have someone in the program that has four DUIs that just happens to be a misdemeanor DUI person, but they're both in the program. They're both successfully graduating. We wanted to avoid some type of an equal protection argument where we're treating those people differently vis-a-vis this license opportunity and allow the court to terminate their revocation and allow DMV or require DMV to restore that license. And so by adding B, you're pulling a very small group of misdemeanant folks in along with the felony folks that have essentially all done the same bad things or conduct, but are now going to, at least the intention here, is to avoid an equal protection problem and treat them similarly. I would conclude my remarks at that point on this amendment. This section of the amendment, and see if there's a question.
I don't see any questions, and I think that it is really important that you put that on the record, and that's great. So please proceed.
Representative Keller, I wasn't sure if I had an idea that perhaps Ms. Thomas from DMV had a concern about this section, and I don't know if the court how the chair wants to handle that, but do you want me to just finish all my remarks through the amendment at this point? And
no, let's, while it's in our minds, let's stop. Tiffany, you had further input on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Tiffany Thomas with Division of Motor Vehicles. my concern with this particular portion of the amendment is that I'm not entirely sure that the division has the statutory authority to amend or terminate a misdemeanor offense as we do with the direct statutory authority in 2835-030-O for the felonies. Perhaps I just haven't seen it yet, but when I was reviewing this, it looked as though 2835-030-B was what was being amended, and I'm hoping Mr. Gardner will correct me if I'm wrong, but that appears to link to the periods of ignition interlock requirement and not the periods of revocation.
Do I see some weeds, Doug?
Representative Keller, you may see some weeds, but I think that certainly what we're trying to reference is we're trying to reference the status of the offender. I mean, we're trying to reference people under B who are misdemeanants and people under N of the statute who are felons and bring those two together. And so we're referencing, our intention was to try and fix this problem by referencing B, misdemeanants, and felons. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's, I won't describe it. I think we understand. Let's go ahead and proceed with the rest of the amendment, and we'll let that one set for a little bit.
The rest of the amendment is pretty straightforward. The rest of the amendment, Chairman Keller, is page 31, line 24, and page 33, line 22. And I drafted this at the request of staff. with respect to coming up with what I believe was a policy call on the best termination date for the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission that is in towards the end of the bill, and I don't have that in front of me right now, but it's in section 38 of the bill. And so I think there was a desire to close out the commission at the end, I think in essence the end of a fiscal year, and so those were why those dates were changed.
Okay. I don't see any questions on that. So we'll go to questions from the whole committee on the amendment number one. And I have one back to page 21, line 25, where we're inserting B. What can you describe what the consequences will be if we do not make reference to, okay, if we include this B2, and Tiffany's right, and they have no authority to proceed, what would be the practical ramifications of that?
Well, I hadn't heard that conversation ahead of time, and as with everything, I'm sorry, Representative Keller, Chairman Keller, I hadn't heard that comment, and so it may be hard to respond to that directly on the telephone if it's the will of the committee to put misdemeanors in the program. Again, this is a limited subset of all the DUI offenders in the state. But if the intention is to treat people who are successful, who happen to be misdemeanors with a whole bunch of DUIs, the same way as felony folks who are successful in the program, who have the requisite number and sequence of DUIs to be felons, then I would be interested in knowing what change that DMV thinks that would be necessary to do that. But the threshold question, I guess, is, is that something that the committee wants to do, treat those people the same way, or just deal with felons? I mean, I would have to say the bill is a whole lot simpler if it just deals with felons, which is what it was doing prior to this hearing. But B would have that effect, at least that's what we think.
Okay. We're going to have Annie come up and comment on the record as things she wants to put on the record. My feeling, but I want to ask Jordan and Ernest to respond to this because they have a better, closer understanding. But I think if we pass this amendment as it is and we include the misdemeanor DUIs in, at least that's the intent of Doug. Can we have some kind of assurance that, that if we were to move this bill out, that you will look at that further in the Finance Committee?
Mr. Chairman, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. We are certainly going to continue working on this. I can assure you that this is something that we'll continually work on through the process.
And then a direct question is that the sponsor, and at least my bias is that it would really be nice to have the misdemeanor element in there. It seems like we ought to be able to somehow come to terms between DMV and the court system and everything and make that work. And we sure have spent a lot of time trying. And so I think that, my bias is let's pass it on, and if we have to tweak later on, we will. But I just want to know if that's kind of consistent with what Senator Coghill may be thinking on this. Okay. Thank you. No other questions this time. Annie, if you'd come up. If you would identify yourself for the record, and
I will. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, your staffer Jim Pound told me before this hearing that, according to his military jargon, since I'm a short timer, I have a chance to be a pain in the neck. But I'm going to try very hard not to be a pain in the neck. But
Mr. Chair, there's another military term which I won't define, but it's FIGMO.
Oh, no, don't go there.
First of all, I'd like to express my appreciation with the staff of both judiciary committees. We've worked really well together on this bill, and it is really a difficult bill. And I think it a part of the difficulty goes back to Title 28 and the need that has been pretty obvious for years that it needs serious rewriting, because it's, over the years we have added things and tweaked things and made things very difficult to understand, and we're doing so again at this point. And having said that, I would like to. I'm just going to focus on the limited license concerns at this point. Just for a little background, under current law, a person who's convicted of felony drunk driving or refusal loses his or her license for the rest of their lives. They have a chance after 10 years to come back and request a limited license or to get their driving privileges back. And we don't believe, the Department of Law doesn't believe, that it's not a good thing to try and figure out a way for people to redeem themselves and have a chance to get a license back if they do so. But we have concerns that this goes too far. It does not protect the public from drunk drivers and people who don't take the breathalyzer test. And I'll start with page. Well, first of all, this allows a person to get a limited license. I'll start on a page-by-page basis. That might be easier for everybody. And let's start back at page 18, line 16. This allows the court to give a person back full driving privileges after driving for 2 years under a limited license. And we think that's just not long enough. Right now, under current law, that this bill does not change, a driver who has been convicted of a felony drunk driver is required to have to use an ignition interlock device for at least 5 years after he or she regains their driving privileges. This allows a license revocation to be terminated after 2 years, and it's not clear how the court would decide whether or not that person still had to use an ignition interlock device after those two years are over. So that's a concern, and just for the public driving safety, we think it should be 5 years at least to drive under a limited license before you get your full privileges of your license returned. On page 18, line 27, it allows a limited license if the person has participated successfully in therapeutic court for at least 6 months. We think it should be a person has completed participation in therapeutic court. And I'll just give you a good example as to why. For example, in Bethel, the therapeutic court there allows people to continue in the program with 5 violations of the conditions of their participation. I think they are terminated after 6. So you could have a person who has had 5 violations be eligible for a limited license for participating for 6 months and not participating particularly successful. We believe that they should at least complete the therapeutic program before they get a limited license.
So just a clarification on that one. Are you saying that you're suggesting that maybe on page 18, line 28, that the or should be and?
No, it should be the person has successfully completed. We should just take participated for 6 months in or. It should be a person has successfully completed a court-ordered treatment program.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
So the amendment, if one is offered, would be to lines 27 and 28 to delete the phrase, quote, participated for at least 6 months in or. That goes out, and it would simply say, I'm sorry, or has successfully. So the language would be a person has successfully completed a court ordered blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
That's our suggestion. And that's what it was in previous drafts. This 6 months
phrase,
was...
You would eliminate the comma after the word completed.
Yeah, go ahead then. We'll get back to these. But right.
And we also would suggest on line 16 that the 2 be changed to 5.
Yes, yeah, I got that.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Didn't hear that?
On page 16, that...
We already covered that, so we just go ahead.
I could just make sure.
Page 18, line 16, change 2 to 5 was the first suggestion.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Page 19, we don't have any problem with a person is required because the court or the department is dealing with these limited licenses. But it's kind of interesting that in this paragraph it says the person is required for the period of the limited license to use an interlock device. And under drunk driving law, 2835.030, I can't remember the subsection, a person with three or more convictions or with a felony has to have an interlock device for 5 years. And it's not clear, and the problem is that courts, when there's confusion over laws or what the legislature was intending, the courts apply what they call a rule of lenity, and they always interpret some sort of confusion over law in favor of the defendant. And in this case, we're talking about the safety of the driving public. On page 19, lines 26 to 28, this is a new iteration of this section. Before it said that the court or department shall revoke a limited license if the person is charged with or convicted of a subsequent drunk driving or refusal offense. This leaves it up to the discretion of the court or the department. Our suggestion is that if a person is charged with a drunk driving or refusal offense, the court may have the discretion to revoke the license, but if they're convicted of it, they should not have discretion. It should be revoked.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
I'm a little slow in the uptake here. Sure. We're talking about page 19, line 26. Is that where we are?
Lines 26 to 28.
And what do you want to say?
Well, it should say that if a person is charged with drunk driving or refusal, the court or the department has the discretion to revoke a limited license. But if they are convicted of drunk driving or refusal, they must... revoke the limited license. I'm trying to go fast because I know you are in a hurry.
No, that's okay. Take your time. This is important. Okay. Okay, 5 minutes spent here might save 2 days. So let's get it clear.
Okay, on page 20, and I think this is an oversight, but it provides that the first conviction for drunk driving or refusal, a person, the sentence may be served by electronic monitoring. And that's a change. You know, in the shock value of 72 hours in prison would be diminished, we think. But it's not clear here where the electronic monitoring is to be served. On the next page, it provides imprisonment served at a private residence must include electronic monitoring. But this appears to allow a person to wear an ankle bracelet and go along his or her daily life with no change besides wearing a monitor. And that probably isn't what you want in terms of discouraging people who get convicted for the first time of drunk driving not to do it again. And the majority of people who are convicted the first time don't reoffend. But I think part of the reason is because of this 3 days mandatory jail time, 72 hours mandatory jail time. So if you're going to allow electronic monitoring, and you do already, I mean, first-time drunk drivers rarely spend it in jail at this point, but I think you ought to say where. So it's not just... I'll wear, it wouldn't be just a fashion statement going around your daily life. I think the intent was to have it in the home or residence or wherever a person is ordered to stay, but it doesn't say that here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Are we on section 32? Is that what you're looking at?
Yes.
And you wanted to, the reason I'm a little bit confused is because I'm more of a visual person than an auditory person, and I frankly do much better if I see some language in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I know that's the normal rule. I'm not trying to be difficult here, but I need to know what we're doing and so I can really look at it, and that's why I'm I'm not trying to be difficult, Mr. Chair. I just want to know what I'm doing.
I know it's difficult to do this. You know, we've been working very cooperatively with the staff of the Judiciary Committees, and we have discussed this. It's just something that, you know, you need to decide.
And again, what I'm going to do is let Jordan respond to the concerns that you raised, and then give the committee the option, you know, of making tweaks if we're going to do it. But again, we're going to get that done today. So I should ask Jordan if you understood the concern on page 20, line 17.
I'm not sure I understand the language you want on page 20 either.
Okay, if you would, if you were to fix the bill the way you wanted it, what would you do?
I would take out by electronic monitoring in lines 27 through 28, and 28. I would just take that out because you're already allowed to serve your term on, look on page 21 on line 3. Imprisonment served at a private residence must include electronic monitoring. It's already allowed under current law that you can serve your sentence for first-time drunk driving at home with an electronic device. So I don't know whether this change is needed, and it just appeared in this latest draft, and I did not prepare any suggestions because I wasn't sure that the committee was going to be able to take.
You thought we'd be hostile to that approach, maybe?
I'd be happy to do that. I could do that. It wouldn't.
Okay,
be
we'll let Jordan respond when we get back to the.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask you a question,
Representative Grunberg?
Just for my own internal bookkeeping, we had Amendment Number 1. In front of us. Did we adopt Amendment Number 1? No, we didn't. And now we're getting into other things. May I make a bookkeeping suggestion here? I think we have completed the discussion. I know what happened. Doug, walked us through Amendment Number 1. You asked Annie to come up to see if she had any problems with Amendment Number 1.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then we got digressed.
Maybe I...
Representative Grunberg, thank you for pointing that out. That was, I'm embarrassed because we did not deal with Amendment Number 1, so what we'll do, and that you're exactly right. I was thinking that Annie was going to come up and speak on Amendment Number 1.
Oh, I'm glad to do that.
Okay. We'll go ahead and do, let's do that, then we'll set your overview of the bill aside. We'll come back to it, but if you would comment on Amendment Number 1, then we'll act on that.
I just have one other thing.
Representative Grunberg?
Do we need a quorum? How about to take the amendment? Maybe we should ask Doug that question.
Doug, are you online? Doug Gardner?
I am Representative Keller, and I see that there are three people in a committee. But is that a seven-member committee or
seven-member committee? Do we need a quorum to we got four. Go ahead. Okay, I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. If we would, Annie, go ahead and comment on Amendment Number 1. By the way, I anticipate that we'll have Representative Pruitt back shortly too. He's juggling between two committees. But go ahead.
The concern I have is the provision on line 20 of the amendment, and that is to, on page 21, add B, which adds all misdemeanor drunk driving offenses into this provision that under which the department is required to restore a driver's license under the circumstances. And I will just tell you our history of working on the limited licenses. We worked on it in Senate Judiciary, and it was taken out because of the difficulty of dealing with this big, rather large change in Title 28. So it was taken out, and then in our working on the bill for this committee with the staff of both judiciary committees, the misdemeanor provisions were taken out because of the difficulty in drafting and the confusion with going back and forth and figuring out what actually the words we were saying had on Title 28. By adding B in one fell swoop, adding misdemeanors, I think I wouldn't even be able to respond to that without going back and reading Title 28 and figuring out what it means in terms of the rest of this bill. So that's a big concern that I have. I just don't know.
Representative Grunberg, on that point, is it? You have a question?
I'm going to make a motion we divide the question, and we take amendment number one, except for the lines that are at issue here, that we take out lines 19 through 20. So that would be, we could call the rest amendment 1A, and that would be 1B. And if we could take the rest without objection, and then however the chair wants to handle 1B, we could maybe have the staff and the departments work on that separately.
Okay, that was to clarify that that motion. You're making a motion that we're going to divide the question, and we're going to take out lines 19 and 20, and that leaves us with amendment number 1 amended. And then we'll have a future opportunity to include B. Is there any objection? Okay. Then amendment number 1 is adopted.
It'd be 1A.
1A, yes. Yeah, Christine, is that clear? Okay, we'll get the records clear, even if we got the words a little bit mixed up on that.
And
so 1A is adopted. Now, is there a motion to move 1B?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I would suggest...
If this is not a motion for 1B...
No.
Okay, is there a motion for 1B?
I was going to make a suggestion, though.
Okay, on that, whether you think it'll...
My suggestion is we're taking other issues now, and that can be one of them, but it may not be the easiest one to deal with, and we may need to give them whatever you need for time.
Yeah. You move Amendment 1B.
I move Amendment 1B.
Okay, Amendment one, number 1B, and I'll object for purposes of just discussion, and that does not preclude at all what Representative Grunberg just suggested. It's still
sorry, Mr. Draft. Chair.
Okay. So anyway, so at that point, we're going to set 1B aside for now. And we'll deal with that after we've heard from everybody. And we'll go back to Annie's comments on the bill as a whole. Oh, Representative Pruitt. Well, I already.
I will say, in terms of language, Mr. Schilling and I have discussed some of the suggestions that I have made, and they are it is available, but I don't have it with me right now. On page 22, again, this is mandatory restoring of a driver's license by the department by DMV. It should be after 5 years of driving, at least 5 years of driving with a limited license to restore. A full driving privileges.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg, that's in line 4, if you're asking that.
Yeah, that was the question.
Okay. Line 4, page 22, should be, we think it should be 5 years driving on a limited license.
I see, 5 years. Okay.
Okay, that's clear. Go ahead and proceed.
I'm almost finished. On page 28, and line 24, and this is dealing with the methodology used by the commission. Somewhere along the line, on line 24, the term violent was inserted to the provision that said that the commission will consider the need to confine offenders to prevent harm to the public. The other provisions pretty much follow the constitutional sentencing provisions in our Constitution. The addition of violent is confusing, for one thing, because it's not in the Constitution, but it seems to be limiting the commission for no good reason. I mean, I don't know what the reason would be. There are a lot of good reasons why people who commit nonviolent felonies or crimes ought to be in jail. I mean, just my first example is Bernie Madoff. He probably ought to be in jail for what he did, but he didn't do anything violent. So I don't know why you'd want to limit yourself to just considering the need to confine offenders to violent offenders. Drug dealers who bring drugs in from outside, they haven't done anything particularly violent, probably, maybe, but they probably, in certain circumstances, ought to be confined to protect the public. I think that's it. And I really appreciate your listening to me. I know this is a tough one, but these are concerns we have based on.
Thank you. And we all went through and noted them carefully. What I'm going to do is ask Jordan to come up, and I'm going to give him the opportunity to respond to anything he wants to, and then I'll bring it back to the committee, and we can follow through with any tweaking amendments that we may feel need to do. So, Jordan, if you would come up and join us. And thank you, Annie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So there were, I think I wrote all of those down, and Ms. Carpinetti and I have spoken about some of these in the past. These weren't really a surprise to me. Some of these are just very clearly policy calls. A couple of the things that the department is concerned about really just deal with durations of time in some cases. So let me see if I can find the first one. The first one, I believe Ms. Carpinetti had us on page 18, line 16. Okay. So this is the part in the bill where we really just have to make a call as to how long this individual must drive successfully under their limited license before they would then be eligible for a regular license that you and I have. And it is true that previous version of the bill had it at 5 years. It was sort of an arbitrary number chosen. We really just have to decide how long this individual must, you know, quote unquote, prove themselves and prove that they are rehabilitated and can drive in a manner that's safe to the public before we take that extra step to give them their regular privilege to drive back. 2 years just felt right to Senator Coghill. It felt that 2 years was enough time for a track record to be laid out where we could be comfortable to give them that back. Although I will say, again, it's just purely a policy call. If the committee is uneasy about having it be just 2 years, I think we can certainly deal with that here. It's Senator Coghill would not be opposed if you guys don't feel comfortable with that. The second duration of time Ms. Carpinetti referenced was page 18, line 27. One thing I did want to correct on the record, Ms. Carpinetti said that previous versions of the bill had this at successfully completed. I don't have version G in front of me. It was the last version of the bill that had limited licenses in it. However, I do believe we simply said is participating in the program in that draft. So that draft, had it been at after really 0 months being in therapeutic course, you could get your limited license. Department of Law would like to have successfully completed before the limited license. So the original version had it at zero. Department of Law would like it at 18 months. 6 months is a compromise. It's meeting partially in the middle, but again, just like the last duration of time we discussed, it's a policy call of the committee. If we are to say that the person must have successfully completed the program before they get the limited license, that's just an extra 18 months. You know, the sooner we get them on the limited license, the sooner that they have all the other accountability measures in place, the ignition interlock, the 24/7 sobriety. Again, though, policy call from the committee.
So it's a given that a court-ordered treatment plan would be 18 months?
That is correct. And I believe Nancy Mead might be in the room. She can talk about how therapeutic courts work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is not in the statute, so, I mean, so that would be just putting it at the discretion of the courts on the length of that. I mean, that's fine. But go ahead and finish your comments.
Ms. Carpinetti.
We'll call Nancy up if there's questions on it. So,
Ms. Carpinetti had a concern on page 19, lines 26 through 28.
What page?
Page 19?
Page 19, lines 26 through 28. I believe I captured what she was saying here. Department of Law would like, it sounds like the department would like the may to be a shall. However, so this would be if the individual has the limited license, they get a DUI or a refusal. This section says the court or the Department of Motor Vehicles can revoke that license. The amendment that the committee just passed, though, however, or no, I'm sorry, is under consideration currently, has a provision in there to allow the court to strip that limited license away if the individual does not cooperate in the therapeutic courts. I believe that a previous version of the bill did have that may be and shall. I think that's something Senator Cockle would be amenable to. It's a policy call like the other things, but if someone does get a DUI refusal, they ought to probably lose their license.
Let me interrupt you there. And Doug, are you still online?
I am, Representative Keller.
Have you been following the conversation? We're on page 19, lines 26 and 27, and the concern raised about whether or not a license shall be revoked if a person is convicted. Is there language there that you might suggest on that? Or?
Well, Representative Keller, rolling with the conversation, I guess I'm asking myself the question, and again, it's a complex area. I share the comments Ms. Carpinetti made, but, you know, if somebody gets a new DUI or somebody gets a new, you know, refusal and they're convicted of that, if they were in this program, they're very likely a felon anyway, and they're going to lose their license for probably a long period of time. So it seems to me that the section, I don't want to, it's difficult on the fly on the phone to make.
Sure, sure.
But I think that it may be that the section can be, section could be removed. I don't know how Ms. Thomas would feel about that. That might end a lot of the problems, and perhaps we could just leave the language that that if the person is not in compliance in the court-ordered treatment program, that they preserve the court's ability while they're on the limited license to take their license if they're not in compliance with the therapeutic court program. But it doesn't strike me that we need to worry about it if they get worry about this section, because if they get a new DUI, that's going to be the limited license is going to be the least of the problem. They're going to lose. They're just simply going to go back into a revoked status. But what seems to be an easy answer might have another twist. So I would encourage the chair to inquire of Ms. Thomas on that one as well before making a decision.
Tiffany, do you want to put a comment on? The committee is going to be making a decision on this today, so this is your good shot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Tiffany Thomas again. I appreciate you letting me comment. Like Mr. Gardner said, it's a little hard to envision all the scenarios on the fly. Off the top of my head, if this was a scenario where a person's on a limited license that was issued by the Division of Motor Vehicles and they got a subsequent DUI arrest, in theory, they would lose their license and would be on a temporary license issued by the DMV. So off the top of my head, I do believe that the language could probably come out because, as Mr. Gardner said, they would subsequently lose their license anyway, pending conviction in court or pending the outcome of the admin side of things.
Thank you, Tiffany. If you would proceed then, Jordan, to the next comment you might have.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Cockill. I believe that's the extent of Ms. Carpinetti's concerns on the limited license aspect, although there is one more thing in Title 28 that she did mention. That was Section 32. That's on page 20. This is the section of the bill that allows a first-time DUI offender to serve their sentence on electronic monitoring. It was our intent to have this really mirror what the Anchorage Assembly passed a few years ago, which is to allow first-time DUI offenders to serve their sentence at their residence on electronic monitoring. So that is the intent. She is correct about that. If we haven't accomplished that with this language, and I would, if you would, Mr. Chairman, have Doug Gardner chime in to see if that's what we've accomplished. If not, it may be something we can look into. I can assure you, though, that that is something we would want to add in the next committee if you'd rather us deal with it there. One thing I would like to correct, though, Ms. Carpinetti said that that this section may not be needed at all because the department already has some discretion about allowing you to serve your sentence on electronic monitoring, but it's that they may allow you to serve it on electronic monitoring. What we're trying to do is make it a shall, and that's a fairly big difference. So, but if you would, Mr. Chairman, I think Doug has a little bit more insight on this.
okay. if I understood Annie Wright Jordan, and I could be missing it, I don't think she was suggesting taking out the whole section. Yeah, she was. Okay, I see now. Yeah. It just, the lights came on. I see, yeah. Okay, any questions for Jordan?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg?
I'm going to sort of defer to you. Right now, I can only say I am confused. And I'm following what you want to do here.
Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to go back, and the first thing we're going to do is act on 1B. Yeah, and then I'm going to give the committee opportunity to offer any tweaking amendments that you may have and put whatever you want on the record, and then we're going to try to act on the bill, and we'll quickly run out of time. So, but we'll go until we get that done. So, any questions for Jordan? Representative Grunberg.
Okay, if we are going to be taking up 1B at this point,
I guess we're done with you for the moment then, Jordan. Thank you. Okay, so we have before the committee 1B, which is I objected to, and it's for our discussion.
I am somewhat confused. It sounded to me, and I may be wrong, that putting 1B in brings in a whole misdemeanor concept into this. And it sounds like the Department of Law would rather have more time to consider that. I don't know what, we've got the public defender on the phone too. I think we probably ought to hear from him on how he feels about that.
Quinlan, did you have any comments? And have you been following what we're talking about here? What we have before us, an amendment to version M. If you like, I will describe it to you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Quinlan Steiner, public defender for the state of Alaska. Are you talking about the amendment that puts in the misdemeanor component into the limited license?
That's exactly right. It's on page 21, line 25, after following under the word under, inserting the words be or.
I followed the conversations and the comments by Doug Gardner. I don't immediately see a problem inserting the misdemeanor component into it, but I'd have to, and I do think that would push off, as Mr. Gardner suggested, some kind of equal protection challenge, because here you'd be granting a limited license privilege to folks with felony convictions, but folks with misdemeanor convictions wouldn't have access to that. But I'd have to look into it in detail to make any further comment than that, because it does have implications elsewhere in the statute.
Okay. For the committee's information, I plan to remove my objection. And will allow you, of course, to further object if you like to. And my reasoning is that this has been worked on now in Senate Judiciary for a long, long time, and has been worked on in this committee by staff a long, long time. And I think it's I don't think it adds a huge risk. I think it probably adds confusion. Because of the confusion between the different jurisdictions over Title 28 in Title 28, and we have included that now as one of the amendments we made to the bill was that the commission does a review of that, and I think all this does is really demonstrates the need for it big time, and I would rather this go forward with the misdemeanor element myself, so I'm going to be removing my objection. In fact, unless you have other comments on it. Okay, I'll remove my objection to Amendment 1B. Is there further objection? Okay, Amendment 1B passes. Now it's before the committee to, if for other tweaking amendments that have come to your mind in this discussion with the Department of Law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Just to be sure that we don't omit at least passing amendments that, you know, forgetting something that somebody said, I would recommend that we sort of go in the order they are in the bill. And we can see, you know, you could say like the first one would be page 18, line 16, It's been suggested that we take 2 years and make it five. Does anybody want to? And just so nobody has to say anything, but so we know that we have, you know.
I think it's a fair assumption that the committee's been paying attention, that you know the different issues that have been brought up.
Yeah.
Are you wanting to make a motion on page 18, line 16?
I am not.
Okay. Well, very quickly, you know, it's we also had the section there in 1827 that talks about necessity to complete and the time issues there. Does anyone have an amendment they want to offer there?
No.
How about the word violent, 2824?
Where is that? I do on that.
Representative Grunberg?
What page is that, sir?
Page 28, line 24.
That was the one that caught my eye.
Did you want to make an amendment, Representative Grunberg?
I'll defer.
Representative Ledoux?
I make a conceptual amendment. Let's call this conceptual amendment number two.
We have 1A, 1B, and now we're on number two.
Okay. Page 28, line 24, delete the word violent.
Any objection?
No objection.
Okay, amendment number two passes.
I just kind of want to be sure we didn't.
We'll just go slow here and let everybody look over their notes and make sure that you've got it covered. But this is your opportunity.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
So a lot of these are already taken care of in amendment number one. And I'm just wondering, on page 19, line 23, we've already dealt with that. Okay. Just for the record, somebody made a suggestion that on page 19, line 26, changing the may to shall. I will not offer an amendment. I like the language the way it is.
It's the will of the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I've just been sitting here turning in my head whether or not I wanted to offer a conceptual amendment on the policy call of the limited license, the time frame. Insurance requires 3 years before they wipe something off. I'm just trying to think, is 2 years enough, and maybe 5 years is too much. I understand that, but I'm almost tempted to maybe put out there, you guys can do it.
This is the opportunity for the committee to do that.
I think I'm going to do that. It would be a conceptual amendment. It would be on page 18, line 16, as well as, I believe, page 22, line 4.
1816.
Yeah. So changed from 2 years to 3 years. Just seems like that's right in line with insurance provisions. And
clarification, we're talking about page 18, line 16?
Yes. And I believe, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but it also the same thing as over in page 22, line 4.
What we're going to do is I'm going to call them at ease and let everybody process a little bit, and then we'll be back on. We're back on the record. Representative Pruitt, if you would repeat your...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go ahead and repeat the... I would move conceptual amendment. I think we're on three now.
Number three, yes.
Line 18...
Page 18.
Page 18, line 16,
where there's two, change that to three, as well as page 22, line 4, where it says two, change that to line 3, or to three.
And we've already had pretty good discussion on it, so I'm not going to object, but somebody can if you want more discussion on it.
I was not paying a lot of attention when you had a discussion here. Is the sponsor okay with the 3 years?
Jordan, if you come up and...
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill, yes, it's a good amendment.
Okay.
I won't object.
Okay. No objections. And amendment number three, conceptual amendment number three passes. Any further conceptual amendments? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Lynn?
Okay. My pleasure to move this bill. House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 64, Judiciary. I believe that's 28-LS0116 /M, individual recommendations and any attached fiscal note.
I want to add that motion is with updated fiscal notes.
It was updated fiscal note.
Thank you.
As amended.
And as amended, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I said as amended.
Before I hit the gavel and say it goes, I want to say that one complex bill, Representative Gruenberg.
Just one question.
Let's see, where are we at here? I got a motion. I guess I'll have to object for you to give that question. So what is your question, Representative Gruenberg?
Okay, thank you. On page 33, line 22, did we at some point... Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. So that should be June 30th. Okay, thank you. Does it. Okay.
Jordan, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to thank you for all the work that you did on this. I thought that the committee was extremely thoughtful. I know Senator Coghill is really appreciative, and just want to thank you.
But I haven't hit the gavel yet.
I know.
As a matter of fact, you still object, don't you?
Before I remove my objection, I do want to say thank you to the committee, too, and this has been a great, great process. So. I'll remove my objection, and seeing no further objection, the bill moves. Thank you. Taking that ease until we get...
Jordan?
What we're going to do is move on to SB 116. We're not going to get to several of the bills, but I saw Senator Egan standing out there, and Jesse's been patiently waiting for a long time. And so I suspect that it won't be as complicated as SB 64, so let's give it a shot.
I hope not, Mr. Chair. thank you very much for hearing this bill. It should be brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Senator Dennis Egan, represent District P, includes Juneau. Senate Bill 116 is more of a housekeeping measure than anything. It fixes an unintended problem with Alaska law that made law enforcement less effective and less fair when it comes to minor offenses. In fact, all members on this committee were members of the 26th legislature, and we voted unanimous for the bill that we're trying to fix. For decades, parking tickets have been left under windshield wipers. A 2010 bill on citations that inadvertently ended that practice by requiring all citations be personally served. That's a problem for Alaskan cities that need to enforce parking and other rules. Taxpayers shouldn't be burdened with paying more parking and animal control officers to stake out cars and front yards when the law is broken, even in a minor way. Since the Alaska court system implemented the law in 2013, some Alaskan cities have used workarounds that are more expensive to administer and effectively deny Alaskans who need to fight a ticket their day in court. Now, Senate Bill 16 lets law enforcement have a ticket or leave a ticket on the rule or real or personal property that is the subject of an infraction or a violation. It also allows service by the same methods as civil process, including certified mail with a return receipt or a process server. The bill still requires personal service by the officer for moving violations, minor consuming, or anything more serious than just a minor infraction. Senate Bill 116 provides more efficient government for Alaskans and gives those who need to fight a ticket fair access to the courts. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my trusty staffer, Jesse Keel, is here to get deeper into the issue if you have further questions.
Representative Ledoux.
When did you say that they inadvertently changed
Talk into the mic, please.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, 2010.
I could swear I've gotten parking tickets under my windshield.
Well, they just, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative, they just implemented the law in 2013.
Let the record reflect that was S tickets.
Tickets.
She admitted to several tickets on the record.
Had they been paid?
I made note of that, Mr. Chair.
Let the record indicate she's nodding in affirmative.
Any other questions?
I have a question. When in 2013? There's probably something out there that I shouldn't have paid.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan. Adopted in March and effective in April of 2013, the Alaska court system changed its court rules to comply with the legislature's 2010 enactment. Many municipalities, in order to keep enforcing their parking laws, used a workaround. Instead of their parking citations being the lowest conceivable level of criminal offense, they made them civil violations. And so those civil violations, not processed by the court system, are not subject to the court system's rules or the statutory criminal rules for service. And so they can be left under a windshield wiper. The problem, as Senator Egan noted, is that if an Alaskan believes that that ticket is unjust, is inappropriate, they don't get to see the judge or the independent magistrate. They get to go to City Hall to fight City Hall with a civil violation. Civil violations are also a great deal more expensive and difficult for municipalities to enforce in most cases. In the case of a scofflaw, someone who doesn't pay a ticket the way Representative Ledoux does, doesn't fight a ticket the way Representative Pruitt is interested in doing, simply throws it away. That's a very, very difficult thing for a municipality to handle with a civil violation. Although I would note, just I'm getting the call sign to be brief from my boss, that there are some municipalities that took their citations, especially for parking civil, years before the legislature's enactment. Anchorage, I believe, has a downtown parking authority. This bill does not force them to go back in the criminal arena. It leaves them the option.
Representative Ledoux.
Do you mean most parking tickets leave you with a criminal record? I mean, just for, you know, you get there 5 minutes late and you haven't put enough money into the meter and that leaves you with a criminal record?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Representative Ledoux, I don't believe that that those records are kept in that way. The minor offense table is handled through the court system's minor offense rules, and I believe there's someone from the court system behind me who can provide you the details. But citations under Alaska law can be written for any misdemeanor, infraction, or violation. In the realm of a municipal violation or infraction, a parking ticket, it's not my understanding that you're going to find those on court view.
Is it here?
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Just for clarification, for the record, we have version O, Oscar, in front of us, and that's what we've been was been described to us. And we have one public testimony here from City of Kenai. We'll hear from him and then come back to the committee and see what you wish. Scott Bloom, are you online?
Yes, I am, Chairman.
Go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Scott Bloom. I'm the city attorney for the City of Kenai. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I ask that you support Senate Bill 116, sponsored by Representative Olson and Senator Egan. The issues addressed by the bill are important to the City of Kenai for three main reasons. The first is public safety. On peak days in July, the city commonly has 10 to 12,000 visitors. And on our busiest day last year, we estimate we had 15,000 visitors to our community. Our local streets, including residential streets and parking areas, are inundated. As word gets out that the city can't issue parking citations, people tend to ignore restrictions, blocking driveways, fire lanes, and emergency access. Being able to enforce parking regulations without requiring personal service would alleviate a large portion of these problems. Second is the strain on municipal resources. Enforcing parking as it currently exists under the laws requiring personal service strains our municipal resources. Without the ability to leave parking tickets, our limited police force must either try and track down drivers to personally serve them, boot the vehicles, or tow them. This takes time and manpower. As an example of this, in 2012, the city issued approximately 106 citations related to personal use fishery in July. And in 2013, because of the personal service regulations as well as some other things, the city only issued 12. As a relatively small municipality, it is difficult at best for us to set up an alternative administrative system to issue citations. Unlike Anchorage or Fairbanks with the economics to support a separate parking authority, this is not a practical solution. The third reason that I ask that you support SB 116 is because I believe it will reduce the cost for the city and public related to citations. If the city must provide an administrative process, it will cost the city time and money, which will be passed on to the public through increased citation amounts. Further, the alternatives of immobilizing vehicles or towing them is exponentially more expensive and burdensome for all parties. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah, Representative Pruitt has a question for you.
So help appreciate your testimony, because I'm trying to understand the scope of the issue here. Help me understand, in Kenai before, or actually let me change that. So currently you guys have to utilize police officers, have to hand a parking citation to the person who has parked in front of a meter, blocked a driveway, those kinds of things. Is that part correct?
Yes.
So your understanding of this legislation would be that you would be allowed to go back to placing those underneath the windshield or the wiper on the windshield, and is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair,
that's all right. Please feel free.
Yeah. So the reason that you're not able to currently place it under the windshields, like I've seen in Anchorage, is because you do not have a separate authority that allows you to take that action.
Correct. Or some other alternative administrative process.
Huh. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux?
So and this is directed to the gentleman, the witness, the testifier right now,
Scott?
Or to Scott, or to Senator Egan, or to Jesse. So that cities that don't have a parking authority, this is parking tickets are criminal?
We'll direct that to the sponsor, Senator Egan or Jesse.
Thank you. Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan. Mr. Chairman, in answer to Representative Ledoux, right now it's a little bit of a mishmash. So you've heard from the city of Kenai. They have not changed their parking laws. So they are still criminal, and therefore to issue a citation, it must be personally served by the officer writing it on the person charged. Here in Juneau, there is no authority, but the city and borough of Juneau has made their parking violations a civil offense. And so they have had to, as Mr. Bloom, as Scott described, they've had to provide an alternate hearing process if you've got a grievance, if you've got a beef with a ticket. You get to go in and see the deputy city manager.
I'll tell you what, before you continue your line of questioning, let's ask Nancy to come up from the courts. Did you want to refresh your question, Representative Ledoux? or do you want to
refresh
respond?
It or follow up on it? I'm not quite sure what I want to do with it.
Go ahead and ask.
So why don't the cities who have problems with the way things are right now, why don't they just change it all to a civil thing like Anchorage does, or like, I guess, Juneau does now?
If you would identify yourself for the record, then.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Nancy May, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, Representative Ledoux. One clarification from earlier, citations that are filed with the court are not criminal. They are minor offenses. It's a whole separate category. It's like a speeding ticket. It is not a criminal offense. They're handled by usually magistrates, and they're fine only. There's no possibility of further consequences. Some cities decide to handle their own parking tickets, and Anchorage, of course, is the largest one. And so if you have a problem, but many other cities only, the court can handle citations for cities if the cities want the court to. And the court, for example, in Kenai handles everything from before 2013, handles everything from parking tickets on to speeding tickets to fish and game citations. Anchorage opted out of that system. So if you get a parking ticket in Anchorage, you go pay at City Hall. If you get a parking ticket from Kenai, you pay through the court system. It's immediately filed with the court, and we handle those trials if somebody asks for one. And the issue with the personal service is that the court enters a default judgment against somebody who doesn't pay. There's actually quite a high number of people who never pay their tickets, and for all citations, it's about a third who don't pay at all. For parking citations, I don't have the breakdown of the subcategory of that off the top of my head. And when a person doesn't respond, doesn't show up, or does nothing with their citation, the court turns that over to the Attorney General's office, their collection unit, to execute on their PFD. Or with certain cities, we have agreements that we give it back to the city, and the city can execute on their PFD. So it's because of those consequences and because of the statute that the legislature passed, that the court requires personal service. Now, non-personal service, that is leaving it under the windshield, is fine in Anchorage. They don't deal with the court on most of their parking tickets. But as the sponsor explained, he would like to also allow Juneau and other cities to go back to the status quo, and the court would handle their parking tickets without personal service, and that's what this bill would do, and the court's neutral on the bill.
Representative Ledoux, follow-up?
I'm fine.
Representative Pruitt?
Ms. Mead, if we have the AEDC, which does the parking tickets in Anchorage, but they only do the downtown area. If someone gets a ticket in a residential area of Anchorage, for instance, parking in front of a fire hydrant, something like that, and that's usually done by a police officer, is the police officer also going to issue the same civil violation that AEDC would downtown at that point, so he can leave it underneath their windshield wiper?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's correct. This, in Anchorage, all parking citations issued by Anchorage police departments are handled through City Hall, unless the person doesn't show and doesn't do anything with it, defaults basically as a scofflaw. After 30 days, the city then issues a warning notice, and then the city turns those over to the court to enter default, and that's a fairly automated thing. But yes, it's for all APD parking tickets.
Okay. One last question.
Representative Pruitt.
So for the minor offenses, if I understand it right now, the Anchorage parking ticket downtown, that would not be listed on court view. Minor offenses, would it be listed on court view?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's correct. Parking tickets would not be on court view until and unless they are turned over to the court for default. So once it enters the court's portals, we assign a case number, and therefore it needs to be managed, and therefore it goes on court view as a default for the parking. Other citations that do come to the court directly are posted on court view with I can see my son's speeding ticket on court view, yes.
Right. Follow-up.
Sure.
Yeah, and I expected speeding tickets. I was thinking more like the parking tickets or the violations, say, for instance, that Scott from Kenai mentioned of, you know, some guy that's parked in front of a driveway or something like that. Is that also going to be in court view? That
through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the distinction is parking versus every other minor offense. And other minor offenses go up to $500. They are like fish and game things. They're mostly traffic, moving violations or not. But the parking ones are the ones that cities keep and can handle themselves. All others come to the court.
Representative Pruitt?
And just one more clarification then. So, but because I'm trying to separate the two, I'm trying to understand, because it sounds like Anchorage and there's a couple cities under one now, and there's everyone else, and I'm trying to understand. So for Anchorage, their parking, that would be handled through them, and only until they hand it over to you would it be potentially listed under court view. For Kenai, if they hand it to an individual at that point in time, even though it's parking, is it still handled? Is it still put in court view, or is that visitor from out of town going to find their parking ticket on court view just because they're not under the same civil authority with this? Anyway, how Anchorage is?
I understand through the chair, Representative Pruitt. Yes, anything that's handled by the court is on court view, unless it's confidential and we aren't in that category. But yes, if the city has opted to have the court handle their parking tickets, then we manage that as a case and post it on court view. In Anchorage, that isn't the case until they want us to default the person. And then, again, it enters the court's doors. We assign a number.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So when you get a parking ticket in Anchorage, you don't have the right to a trial by jury, public defender, or any of those other panoply of rights. So if you get a parking ticket in Juneau, which is handled by the court system, do you actually have the right to a jury trial and that sort of thing?
No, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, minor offenses don't have the right to a trial by jury. They don't have the right to preempt judges. They don't have a right to an attorney. It's just different ways that cities have opted to handle this subcategory of minor offenses, but in no instance do they receive those.
Thank you.
Looks like we're all going to have to pay our traffic tickets, right? Parking tickets. Anybody else online or in the room that want to testify on SB 116? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would, before we have any more confessions, I'd like to move CS for Senate Bill number 116 of State Affairs, 28-LS0826/O, with individual recommendations and any fiscal notes.
Attached fiscal notes. Okay, great. Seeing no objection, 116 moves. Thank you. And thank you, Senator Egan. We're going to gavel out here, and we'll come back and try to pick up the pieces on the schedule. Watch the schedule, and you'll see what's up first. Anyway, with that, we're out at 3:32.